you turn momentarily to Psalm 104. Psalm 104. Between Palm Sunday and Mother's Day, we've been away from the Psalms of Creation for some 5 weeks. This summer, Lord willing, we'll finish the Psalms of Creation, and we'll turn to the penitential Psalms, and then finally to several messianic Psalms. I remind you that we are pursuing the themes of creation, fall, and redemption right through the Psalter. In Psalm 104, and verse 30, we found a delightful line concerning God's Spirit that we have looked at often. The psalmist declares, Psalm 104, 30, "When you send forth your Spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground." The passage echoes the second verse of the Bible where God's Spirit is seen brooding like a mother bird over the early creation. God's Spirit breathes life, energy, and conscious awareness into nature. One of the greatest mysteries in all of science is life itself. Scientists have never adequately defined the life of a creationist or evolutionist. What distinguishes them is not a definition of life, but a recognition of the source of all life. Creationists insist that you cannot derive life from nothing. The greatest principle in all biology and absolute scientific law is that life begets life. There are billions of creatures on this planet, and without exception, they are produced from living sources. Creationists merely insist that what applies to life equally applies to the origin of all life. We insist on the scientific law that life produces life. Every living thing, from the tiniest little cell to the great blue whales diving into great ocean depths, is sourced in a living creator. A biblical view of reality provides the only legitimate foundation for the entire scientific enterprise. But of course, much of the world does not understand the way science the way that we do. They haven't for a very long time. On June 8, 1978, Russian literary giant, former Gulag inmate, and American exile Alexander Solzhenitsyn addressed a graduating class at Harvard University. The occasion was his reception of an honorary doctorate. Solzhenitsyn had defied Stalin's communist regime, and had been celebrated in the capitalist West. However, Solzhenitsyn was never so enthusiastic about American consumer culture as many Americans thought. Solzhenitsyn frequently warned us that despite America's great material success, something was rotten at the core of our society. Certainly, America was better off for not having a communist regime. We don't have prison camps. We don't have the evils of Stalinism, Solzhenitsyn said. But something was still terribly wrong in America. Since the 18th century Enlightenment, Solzhenitsyn argued the West had abandoned the spirit. Our technological progress had subtly stripped away the notion of God's Spirit animating all creation. I want to quote selectively from his speech, a very famous speech that he gave. He said, "How did the West decline?" This is 1978. "How did the West decline from a triumphal march to its present sickness? The West kept advancing socially in accordance with its proclaimed intentions and with the help of brilliant technological progress. And all of a sudden, it found itself in its present state of weakness. This means that the mistake must be at the root. I refer to the prevailing Western view of the world, which was first born during the Renaissance and found its political expression from the period of the Enlightenment. This view could be defined as rationalistic humanism or humanistic autonomy. What is that? He continues to proclaim and enforce autonomy of man to any higher force above him. There's no one up there. It could also be called anthropocentricity. What's that? Well, he continues, of man seen as the center of everything that exists. And then he said to all those Harvard graduates, we turned our backs upon the spirit and embraced all that is material with excessive and unwarranted zeal. He continued, a total liberation occurred from the moral heritage of Christian centuries with their great reserves of mercy and sacrifice. State systems were becoming increasingly and totally materialistic. Man's sense of responsibility to God and society grew dimmer and dimmer. All the glorified technological achievements of progress, including the conquest of outer space, do not redeem the 20th century's moral poverty, which no one could imagine even as late in the 19th century. And that's a lot to work through, and that's just a portion of his speech. But the center of that discourse is the notion that despite all of our wealth and technological progress, we are impoverished by the loss of the spirit. We are morally bankrupt as a civilization. Now, let's be really clear. I would rather visit a modern hospital than a medieval hospital, wouldn't you? I am thankful to drive a 2023 Honda and not a Model T, especially if it's raining and have a roof over my head. I am grateful to fly across the country on a Boeing 737 in a single day, rather than taking a 6-month passenger journey on a conestable wagon. Aren't you? So Solzhenitsyn understood the value of technology in this sense. Nevertheless, there is a very subtle danger in technology. Neil Postman, whom I've quoted before, defined technology as the manipulation of nature so that you don't have to experience it. A cell phone manipulates the 1,500 miles between me and my brother, who's out in Colorado, so we can communicate as if we're standing right next to each other. An air-conditioned car manipulates my environment so I don't experience the cycle of rain, snow, heat, and humidity that affect the environment between my home and my office. What many people call camping isn't camping at all. They haul a huge trailer into the woods with a propane-fueled refrigerator and stove, and they plug in their devices to the generator. That's not. Now, again, all of this is wonderful. But here's the question. Does nature exist simply to be overcome or to be enjoyed? Is nature merely an obstacle to human progress, or is nature the space where we meet and enjoy our Creator? As we exercise dominion in creation, do we actually enjoy the Creator through all of His works? The problem with modern civilization, according to Solzhenitsyn, is that we have rebelled against God's Spirit who animates all creation. Do we use our powerful telescopes to discover the glories of the Creator, or to invent absurd theories concerning the godless origin of the universe? Do we discover the thousands of created species only to invent theories concerning the common ancestors from whom we all evolved millions of years ago? How are we using our scientific tools? Those faith and fear that the West, whether the godless Soviet regime or the capitalist United States, have lost sight of the Spirit of God moving through all creation. Now, for centuries, theologians spoke of natural theology. They meant by that term the revelation of the Creator in all of His creation. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. For centuries, the church understood that a journey into creation was a journey into Eden. Now, of course, Eden is fallen, but even in her marred condition, nature still sings the greatest praises. Have we forgotten to slow down and listen to the voice of nature to discover the Spirit of God? That was so confusing question to all those gathered. I love trail running through God's beautiful creation. Running on asphalt is purgatory. My daughter has a trail running shirt that says, "Unpaved the roads." Unpaved the roads. Running through God's trees and valleys and leaping over His streams will just renew your spirit. And even so, I often carry my cell phone, which wirelessly delivers an audiobook via my battery-powered bone-conduction shocks right into my ears, and I'm carried off to some other place, but I knew it was yours. One day, I took Asher out, and we slowly walked the trail that we often run. It was evening. Billowing white clouds scudded across a sea of blue. A cool breeze caressed the treetops. The sun's rays slanted to the oak, leaving halos of gold around emerald leaves. Birds chirped and flitted to the branches. Tiny flecks of mica reflected patches of sunlight along the dirt path. On again, off again, they blinked in rhythm with the passing clouds. I asked Asher to imagine God, taking a leisurely walk to the Garden of Eden in the cool of the day. I said to Asher, "Let's look for all the things that God made." He responded, "Dad, God made everything." Of course He did, but let's look more closely and let's identify the things that God made. Wasn't that Adam's job? Go out and name everything, slow down and look at it. Distinguish it from everything else. Naming creation forces us to look more closely, to notice the individual glory of each thing that God has made. A tiny ant suddenly dashed across a room on a mysterious mission. Where was she going? How did her six legs work in unison to carry her upright, sideways, and upside down as she crested over the curvature of the branch? What did the world look like from her viewpoint? How would she find her way home? How did Yahweh cram 250,000 neurons into her tiny little ant brain, allowing her to communicate, avoid predators, engage in courtship, navigate long distances, build colonies in community, burrow tunnels to the ground, forage for food, and race up a tree trunk? What a splendid little creature. Proverbs 6, verse 6, instructs us to go to the ant and consider her ways and be wise. We came across a sea of tiny green ferns, spread their leaves like intricate mathematical fractals. Thousands of them erupted to the identity of this compost of last year's fallen trees. I had run past them hundreds of times, and now I stop to observe them. how do they absorb nutrients from the soil? You have to ask them. How do they conduct water through their veins and transform the light into chemical energy through photosynthesis? That's a big word. I don't understand it. There's an old saying, one can't see the forest for the trees, but stop and look at the trees. How did a tiny little acorn transform itself into a majestic oak? You know, that question fascinated Aristotle, the great philosopher. How does that happen? A little acorn becomes a great oak tree. The oak is millions of times larger. We know the acorn transformed itself by collecting sunbeams, traveling 93 million miles from the sun. How mysterious is that? How many highways of corrugated bark went up and down the trunk? Well, the ants could tell us. How many miles of capillary canals draw water up from the roots, defying gravity, and push it out in the leaves and branches? A large oak drinks in, get this, 100 gallons of water a day. A mighty sequoia out in California, 500 gallons of water per day. I'm glad I don't have to water a tree, aren't you? Whose job is it to water the whole forest? Aren't you glad the Spirit renews the face of the ground? Now understand, put to good use, technology can be a wonderful tool to investigate nature. I use the internet to find out how many gallons an oak tree drinks. Aren't you glad the internet? I wouldn't know that. Aristotle knew nothing of photosynthesis or neurons and membranes. We know so much more. But when technology is used merely to overcome nature rather than to enjoy nature, our experience of God's creation is severely impoverished. That was Solzhenitsyn's point. Science should not rob nature of God's Spirit. Science should produce wonder and awe at the rejuvenating power of God's Spirit in all of creation. But how do we come to ignore the Spirit? Well, let's turn next to Nehemiah chapter 9, and let's explore this question. Nehemiah chapter 9. The Solzhenitsyn Western civilization declined with the Enlightenment, when secular humanism was born. We are a product of that culture, the birth of the Enlightenment. Secular humanism views man as the pinnacle of evolutionary development. It also views man as nothing more than matter. Man is a machine. Man is material. The Enlightenment embraced a purely physical world. When that happens, Solzhenitsyn says, we abandon the Spirit. We lose our own Spirit, and we lose the Spirit of God. Neither exists in a purely physical world. The 18th century Enlightenment began a process of pushing God out of his creation. Now, Enlightenment philosophers were not quite atheists like many of today's naturalists, but they were deists who paved the way for atheism. They pushed God out of the margins of creation. According to deism, God may have created all things originally, but God hasn't gotten involved since. God wound up nature like a clock, and it's been ticking along without him ever since. That's deism. God retired at the end of the creation week, and no one has heard from him since. That's deism. But deism was only the first step. After the deists came the naturalists, men like Charles Darwin and Sigmund Freud and Karl Marx and host of epigrams. If the species evolved, Darwin suggested, maybe we don't need a creator at all. In a survival of the fittest world, the species claw their way up to the top of the food chain, and man has arrived at the pinnacle, and man is the measure of all things. But here is the irony of a materialistic, naturalistic worldview. Naturalism places man in an adversarial relationship with nature. nature is merely an obstacle to be overcome, rather than the place where we enjoy God's Spirit, rejuvenating, refreshing, and enjoying this creation. In naturalism, our task is merely to survive. We only survive in nature, we don't enjoy nature. Now, it is true that the fall did render nature harmful, even deadly. Echoes of Eden, though, can still be seen and heard in the beauty of creation around us. The Bible views the Creator at this very moment as everywhere present, providentially ruling, preserving, and protecting the fallen creation until the arrival of the new creation. If you look at Nehemiah 9 and verse 6, "You are Yahweh, you are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven the heaven of heavens, with all their hosts, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve," look at that, "you preserve all of them, and the host of heaven worships you." Nehemiah defies both the atheist and the deistic worldviews. God is not merely the creator, but God is also the preserver of all creation. At this very moment, God is watering the host of every forest. He is guiding the tiny ant on our mission to secure food for the colony. If only we could hear the voice of nature. If only we could hear it worshiping its creator. If only we could return to Korea. Again and again in the Psalms, we have seen this theme of preservation and God's providence in all creation. Again and again, the psalmist in Psalm 104 viewed Yahweh as active in his creation, not only as creator, but as providential ruler of creation and provider for all of his creation. The psalmist declared, "You make spring gush forth in the valleys." What becomes of that water? The psalmist declares, "They give drink. Every beast of the field, the wild donkeys quench their thirst." God waters his creation. All the wildlife out there, God waters and feeds them all. And sometimes we marvel at Yahweh's power in the Exodus when he sent a stream of water gushing from the rock to feed his children in the wilderness. That was indeed miraculous. But the truth is, God sends forth every stream of water on every continent, in every forest, in every field, and he nourishes all of his beasts. So with both Psalm 104 and Nehemiah 9 in place, let's turn at long last to Psalm 145. And we're going to go very quickly through Psalm. Psalm 145 is a psalm that moves us to praise Yahweh for his glorious preservation of all of his creation. Psalm 145. When you read through the Psalter, the Psalms begin moving toward a crescendo. By the time you read Psalm 150, all of creation re-echoes Yahweh's praises all through the universe. But there is a momentum that begins to build right here in Psalm 145. In Psalm 145, David begins with a resolution. Verse 1. "I will extol you, my God and King, and bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you and praise your name forever and ever." In David's view, God is the true King. Further, God is worthy of praise for all eternity by name. Notice how David does not really praise God in the abstract. Too many Americans with a deist outlook think it's sufficient merely to acknowledge some beauty in the sky up there. Well, David determines to bless God by name. But what is God's name? Well, look at verse 3. "Great is the Lord," that's Yahweh. "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable." Again, L-O-R-D In all capital letters, that's Yahweh. That's God's covenant name. Yahweh is the name of the God who we praise. Yahweh is the God whose greatness is utterly unsearchable. That's whose name he's praising. Friends, I can't begin to comprehend the move of a single man across a kingdom, or the transportation of 500 gallons of water into the lens of the mighty Sequoia. That's astonishing. The creator of all the species is indeed unsearchable. We will never exhaust the knowledge of God revealed in the tiniest insect or the largest tree. In Psalm 139, we discover God's unsearchable greatness revealed in our own humanity. We cannot even begin to fathom a single one of ourselves, much less all of our humanity. But here's what we can do, despite our limitations. Verses 4 through 7. One generation shall commend your works to another, and shall declare your mighty acts. On the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works, I will meditate. They shall speak of the might of your awesome deeds, and I will declare your greatness. They shall pour forth the fame of your abundant goodness and shall single out of your righteousness. These verses express our obligation to declare Yahweh's glory to each new generation. And further, to meditate, think of that, to meditate on Yahweh's extraordinary deeds. Now, the passage could turn our attention to Yahweh's revelatory acts in human history. That is true. But for our purposes today, it could equally refer to Yahweh's revelatory acts in nature. There is indeed a sense in which this has been going on for centuries by humans who do not even know the name Yahweh. Do you realize that? Unbelievers are out there exercising dominion in God's creation, even if they fail to acknowledge Him. And unbelievers have made astonishing, truly astonishing scientific discoveries. And unbelievers have long been fascinated by the marvels of creation, even if they do not acknowledge the name Yahweh. And we can learn a great deal about nature, even from people who do not know the Creator. I have heard atheist scientists describe the staggering complexity of the cell and the enormous size of the universe out there. And the descriptions fill me with awe at the majesty and the wonder of God. Because God can communicate truth to a donkey. He can communicate truth to anyone if he so chooses. So God has allowed unbelievers to make truly stunning discoveries in his universe. And we've got to take that all in and be in awe of our Creator. Now, of course, Paul says in Romans 1, they are without excuse. Those same people are without excuse because they have really truly come to see God in all His glory in His creation. So think of verses 4 through 7 as an endorsement of the history of scientific discovery. Or frankly, an endorsement of your vocation should you choose to go into science, and particularly becoming a teacher like Nancy Kress. Right? What a long, wonderful career she had teaching science. And in the next incarnation, I'm not going to say that. I would love to teach science someday, but I'm not good at it. One generation passes to the next. It's incredible discovery. That's what we're supposed to be doing. You know that the vast majority of wonderful crops that we eat come from the ancients who discovered farming techniques that still fill our bellies today. That's one generation passing down the next generation the glories of what they discovered in creation. Again, in the 4th century B.C., Aristotle marveled over the development of the mighty oak, Latini acorn. Would you do that sometimes? Just go out and pick up an acorn. And just look at that thing. How did that acorn become a huge oak tree? Aristotle thought, that is absolutely wonderful. 2,400 years have gone by, and we are still pursuing Aristotle's dream of understanding the tree. And there are trees on our planet that have been growing since the days of Aristotle. Now, verse 6 speaks of a might of Yahweh's awesome deeds being passed along to succeeding generations. And that was precisely what Israel was tasked with doing every Passover, to rehearse Yahweh's absolute power over nature, demonstrated in Egypt's Exodus, the 10 devastating plagues. And that is the task that Christian scientists and historians have today, to pass on to the next generation what we know about God. Verse 7 speaks of our obligation to be effusive in our praise. Pour out like a flood of water the fame of Yahweh's superabounding goodness. Now notice how David turns from praise to acknowledgement of Yahweh's mercy and love for all creation. Verses 8 and 9. The Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all, and his mercy is over all that he has made. And these verses remind us instantly of the Noahic covenant. We deserve wrath. We deserve destruction, generation upon generation. There has never been a generation on this earth who properly worshiped Yahweh as the creator of all things. Not a single one. And yet God has extended his steadfast love and mercy toward all creation. It really is a marvelous testament to Yahweh's providential preservation of all that he has made. We live right now under the Noahic covenant. Aren't you thankful? It is true the whole world lies under a curse, but even so, Yahweh's mercy is ever present, generation upon generation. He is not a God who retired eons ago from his creation, but a God who extends his mercy to all that he has made. The psalmist continues in this vein in verses 10 through 13. All your work shall give you thanks, O Yahweh. And all your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of the glory of your kingdom and tell of your power. To make known to the children of man your mighty deeds and the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures through all generations. Notice the connection between three things. Number one, Yahweh's works. Number two, the obligation of praise. Number three, Yahweh's kingdom. Consider the first two. David speaks of Yahweh's work, giving thanks. That's another way of saying we ought to be full of gratitude for all that God has done. All of God's actions summon us to give thanks. Think of that. All of God's actions summon us to give thanks. God has never done anything that gives us the right to be ungrateful. We have no grounds whatever for ingratitude so long as we live in Yahweh's glorious creation. But what does it mean to express gratitude to Yahweh? Well, for one thing, it means make known to our children and to all children of mankind everywhere the glories of Yahweh. And not only that, but render praise to Yahweh for his creation, for his kingdom. Contextually, Yahweh's kingdom is his everlasting rule in all of his creation through all generations. That's his kingdom. It was true in Abraham's day, in Hannah's day, in Peter's day, in our day, is Yahweh's everlasting rule. The Bible knows nothing of a distant God who abandoned his creation after completion. Quite the opposite. Just keep reading. At the end of verse 13 is one of the few debated passages. It does not occur in most manuscripts, but it certainly expresses biblical truth. So let's read it. The Lord is faithful in all of his words and kind in all of his works. And now verse 14, the Lord upholds all who are falling and raises up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food in due season. You open your hand, you satisfy the desire of every living thing. The Lord is righteous in all his ways and kind in all his works. When's the last time you thought about the kindness of God toward you? And notice the strong, providential note the psalmist strikes in verses. Not only does Yahweh reign, he cares deeply for his creation. Again and again, the Old Testament speaks of God's care for the downtrodden, the oppressed, the widow, the orphan, the stranger. He cares for those wounded and bowed down under the weight of the curse, even if we did bring that curse upon ourselves. And truly, there's no more basic need that all creation has than the need for food. But all creation looks to Yahweh for their food in due season. He feeds the tiny ants foraging in the forest with tiny crumbs too small for us even to observe. He feeds the great blue whale with 16 metric tons of krill in a day. How much food is that? That's more than 8,000 hamburgers in one day. He feeds them in season, in the bright, poor summers before their winter migrations begin. Yahweh has supplied vast grasslands all across this world. In fact, every continent has grasslands except Antarctica. Grasslands are the globe's most agriculturally useful habitats. They feed untold billions of creatures, from insects to great herds of elephants. If you take a journey into the Great American Plains, you will find badgers, bison, ferrets, owls, coyotes, deer, eagles, foxes, gophers, hawks, rabbits, meadowlarks, moles, prairie chickens, prairie dogs, antelope, rabbits, skunks, snakes, sparrows, foxes, wolves, and woodchucks. And not only that, you'll find all the farm animals like cows, horses, pigs, sheep, cats, and dogs. They're all out there in those grassy plains. The whole animal ecosystem would disappear instantly without grass. The Lord opens his hand and he feeds all of his creation. Yes, the creation has fallen. Yes, the carnivores that are the grass eaters. Not all things are now as they will be in the future. But the doctrine of God's common grace tells us God is preserving his fallen creation right now, until the arrival of the new creation. When we think of common grace, it's God's preservation of his fallen creation until the new creation arrives. God's goodness. So what then is the application of all this? Well, the psalmist's answer is to turn and to embrace Yahweh, verse 18. Yahweh is near to all who call on him. All who call on him in truth. He fulfills the desires of those who fear him. He also hears their cry and saves them. Yahweh preserves all who love him, but all the wicked he will destroy. Verse 18 defies the deist, and certainly the atheist as well. Yahweh is not distant. Yahweh is not slumbering somewhere out there beyond the stars. Where is he? He's near. Well, just how near is he? He opened his hand and he fed you this morning. Isaiah asked, can a nursing mother forget her nursing child? Of course not. It's unthinkable. She feeds the children of her own womb. And Yahweh feeds his children. Now, occasionally, very rarely, we read those unnatural stories of a mother abandoning a child. But listen to what Isaiah says. Can a woman forget her nursing child that she should have no compassion for her womb? Even, this is highly unusual, even these may forget, yet I will not forget you. Even if your own mother were to forget you, Yahweh will never forget you. call on him, call on him in truth, he will come. All who call on him. Verse 19 is the gospel. The Creator hears their cry, and he comes to save you. And there in verse 20 is the doctrine of providence, of preservation. Yahweh will preserve those who love him. If he can feed the tiny ant and the great blue whale, if he can supply 500 gallons of water from the giant sequoia, he can meet your needs. This is what Jesus told us in the Sermon on the Mount. If he clothes the flowers of the field, he will clothe you. Now, God's promise is tempered with a warning. He has no choice but to destroy the wicked. And contextually, the wicked are those who fail to acknowledge him as their creator. Those are wicked people. Those who do not call on him, we have to speak the truth about them. They are wicked people. All those who refuse to call on him of Yahweh, those who deny the existence of the Creator or relegate him to the margins of creation, all those who refuse to acknowledge his everlasting rule in all creation, those are the wicked whom he must judge. So what then is the psalmist's final verdict? Verse 21. My mouth will speak the praise of Yahweh. Let all the flesh bless his holy name forever and ever. David completes his song of creation where he began, with personal resolution. David resolves to praise Yahweh. And David completes the song with aspiration. Aspiration that all flesh everywhere would praise not just God in the abstract, but his holy name, Yahweh, with the name Jesus Christ forever and ever.